start off the day with a story about healing hands. This past weekend, we paid a visit to what the military says was a de facto dog beach at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam, but it was right up against a coastal marsh, home to endangered native Hawaiian birds. Canines and fowl don't mix. Talks between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Navy ended the practice of allowing dogs to roam in the area. And then came the work of restoring the natural habitat in this area known as Ohua Reef Wetlands. We were there walking the shoreline in the marsh to see the progress and to see how community volunteers and cadets with the Youth Challenge Academy were digging in. The event was part of National Public Lands Day. This stretch of beach at Fort Kamehameha is just a stone's throw from the airport's reef runway, so it's a strange mix of gentle waves lapping, airplane noise, and bird calls off in the distance. Here's Colonel Doug Pierce explaining the situation.
It's known as Dog Beach. People would take their pets out there, but obviously not good for the environment, not good for our stilts.
The Hawaiian stilt, or Io, is one of a number of native birds that call this area home. Dozens of volunteers have come out to help heal the land, clearing out invasive species and planting native shrubs and trees. Kehaulani Lam of the Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs is grateful the military has been welcoming to this community, reaffirming their cultural connection to the Aina, which were once part of Crown Lands.
We're so blessed today because we have cadets who would like to offer oli to Ahua, to this sacred space.
Oh my,
volunteers who want to help plant this willy willy tree.
Following cultural protocols, it's then time to pick up the shovels and wheelbarrows and get to work planting and clearing. Craig Gorsuch is a biologist with Native Facilities Hawaii.
It loves this habitat right here. And you can just open it. And just like that. That's all there is to it. And they get 10 to 12 inches apart, and they love to have their feet wet, so this edge here between the mud and the gravel is perfect for Bacopa. The other plants are going to plant higher up. And there are all these trays here, so. And when other people finish with propagules snapping, they can join you. You know, I feel very connected to this land, this wetland area. And Ahua Reef is a wetland area that's gone through a lot of an invasive flora assault, I could say, where red mangrove and pickleweed battis, genus battis, have come in and they've taken over. And it's interesting to see what the consequence of that is. When you came out here before, when you go back in the areas that are overgrown with red mangrove, it's very quiet. It's very sterile. You don't hear bird life. You don't see native water birds. You might see an occasional pig, but there's not much life in the land, which is ironic because the mangrove is so productive in other parts of the world, in the Philippines, in Florida, and Central America, but not here in Hawaii. It did not arrive on its own. And
so they're invaders.
They literally are invaders. And we're trying to, turn the tide in a way to help the native plants and in process encourage native water birds to come back, including endangered water birds. And that is happening. We have the Io, the Hawaiian stilt, has come back here, and it's foraging and it's roosting, and we're hoping it will breed.
So it's really kind of restoring the Aina is what you're doing.
Very much restoring. Malama the Aina. And I can share with you why I feel that's important. When you talk to botanists, they have an idea of what plants arrived on their own. For plant seeds to get here, it's a long, arduous journey that has to travel 2,000 miles across an ocean surface. And that's only going to happen by wing or by wind or by water. So spores that are small enough can float in the air. Or seeds could stick to feathers of coloa that are traveling here, or colea. And seeds can float as long as the embryo of the seed can survive the salt water. They can float here. But that happens slowly. And geologists feel that the islands from the very beginning, the first hotspot island that formed, could go back 70 million years, maybe 27 to 70 million years from the people I talked to, geologists. And botanists feel there have been like 275 flowering plants that arrived on their own across that time. So that boils down to like one flowering plant every 100,000 years arrived on its own in Hawaii. And when it arrived here, very stable conditions with temperature and wind and water. So they grew and they adapted and they thrived. With the introduction of alien plants, I like to call it alien plants, the Polynesians brought canoe plants that are wonderful. Others, Europeans and Americans, brought flowering plants. Part of the struggle is that a lot of those plants grew up in an area where they competed already with a larger ecosystem. So they developed skills to grow fast, to outcompete, to suck up the most nutrients. And because of that, they sometimes can outcompete native plants and take over. What's amazing is when fresh lava flows, like we've just experienced on the Big Island, the first colonizer plants are native Hawaiian plants because they can survive with the limited micronutrients in the lava.
So what do we have here at Ahua Reef in this marshland?
We've removed the invasive red mangrove and pickleweed. We're also have a lot of kiawe that we're controlling as well. What we're bringing in are plants like these orange-flowered ko trees, and we've been able to broadcast seeds, and they grow quite well. Another plant that loves to have its feet wet is called ai, which is bacopa, or water hyssop. And it tolerates salt, and it's a great ground cover for native water birds to forage in and even eat parts of the plant itself.
These are good healers.
They're good healers, and so many of these plants have medicinal or cultural significance from that standpoint. Another plant we're bringing in is called a kuli kuli, which grows a little higher up. It's kind of like a succulent, and it's also edible. I'm not recommending people to eat it unless they know it's clean, but it has like a cucumber crisp leaf that's a little salty, and it is great in salads. So that's another plant that we're introducing here. Another plant is nehei, which is a ground cover that gets a yellow flower. Another plant is some native grasses the names are just slipping me on my mind right now.
Okay.
I just need a little help. A beautiful vine that gets a white flower. It's like a morning glory with a yellow center called hunakai, and it grows on beach. And these plants really thrive in harsh conditions of dry, drought, salt, and sun. So they do quite well out here. I mentioned nehei that we're planting out here. Another grass, it's like a button grass, that's called mau'u'u'akiaki. Thrives out here. We're going to be planting that one out here today. So another grass we planted here is called makaloa, that likes to have its feet wet. So these are all wonderful ground covers. And when we plant flora out here, we like to have open spaces of low ground covers with interspersed taller vegetation that provides cover for native birds and then trees. So this area is transforming into that kind of ecosystem.
So it's pretty exciting then to see the progress.
Oh my gosh, it's tremendously exciting when you see the before and after pictures. I mean, standing here right now, it's all open with a lot of ground covers, and it was not like that 5 years ago.
And so tell us when you started to see, like, the birds maybe coming back.
It came right away, which is remarkable. When we removed the red mangrove and exposed mudflats, the mudflats have the crabs and the invertebrates and the fish that these water birds feed on. so they come right in. It's like a picnic. And we're also trapping predators out here, like mongoose and rats and cats. I'd say at this point, that's the biggest pressure on the water birds are mongoose. They're very efficient protein scavengers. So it's hard, the nesting water birds and mongoose are not compatible. So the water birds are here, like the Hawaiian stilt. We're encouraging them to nest. And hopefully, as we continue controlling predators, they will nest successfully. But
and then we'll hopefully we'll see little baby chicks.
so much I hope so, and see the birds here. One of the benefits of having this wetland here, it's located away from the airfield. So these birds are in a safer area away from the airfield, and that's part of the intention.
And hopefully they'll rebound quickly.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and you can, right now I don't hear the birds, but when we come here in the morning we hear the IOs calling with their stilt call. It's quite beautiful.
Slowly but surely, the native plants are taking hold, and the coastal marsh area known as Ahua Reef is rebounding. It is Dog Beach no more. I'm Catherine Cruz on HPR1. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we don our scuba gear to go underwater and check out the remains of an aircraft that sank over seven decades ago in Honolulu waters. As the story goes, the pilot was on a routine mission flying near Hawaii Kai when his engine began to fail. Being a seasoned airman, he executed a smooth water landing, wheels up, flaps slightly extended, and successfully touched down with no damage to the plane. Unfortunately, with no way to lift the craft out of the water, gravity took over and the plane was sucked under the waves and eventually settled at the bottom of the ocean. Meanwhile, the pilot was plucked out of Monolulu Bay wearing his life jacket. Over time, the crash site became a popular destination for divers. The watery grave of the World War II craft is teeming with aquatic life. Fish and garden eels are plentiful. Jack and stingrays are said to frequent this site as well. For today's quiz, what is the name of this dive site? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Emily Cardinelli from the School of Pacific and Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
It's a traveling show designed to capture the imagination of youngsters, helping to get them into STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. Take a listen to skateboarder Eric Tumabritton of the film Lords of Dogtown talking about how he uses math.
Math is in everything. Math is exciting.
Touch and slide the wheels to position them on the board.
Math is extremely important in what I do. The length of the board and the size of the wheels would determine whether I'm able to do a trick like an ollie. So it plays an extremely huge role in skateboarding. Math is in everything. Math is exciting.
Touch and slide the wheels to position them on the board.
Math is extremely important in what I do. The length of the board and the size of the wheels would determine whether I'm able to do a trick like an ollie.
We sat down with John Patterson, who's with Raytheon, a defense contractor behind the traveling show, to understand why it sunk so much money into the exhibit designed to make math fun.
Raytheon is an aerospace and defense company, and so we succeed or fail depending on how many talented engineers we have. We have lots of talented engineers, but we need to maintain a talent pipeline. We need these engineers to come through the ranks and replace those who are retirement eligible. So we realized that not only was Raytheon struggling to recruit engineers because there are fewer of them out there, but it's really a national imperative. We've got other countries that are graduating more engineers annually than the United States. So here's the U.S. at risk of losing its technological edge, and here are companies such as Raytheon struggling to find engineers. So how do we solve that? And we decided that we would take a large percentage of our community outreach efforts and pour them into STEM education. Math Alive is a traveling exhibit that shows students how math is used every day in their lives. Whether you're surfing on Waikiki, right, there's math there. Anything they do really has math associated with it. So we're showing them the fun side of it in these interactive displays.
So kind of really connecting the dots.
Yeah. And it's interesting. When the young people go into the exhibit for the first time, you know, as adults, we want to manage it, right? Okay, go over here. But you don't have to. They immediately gravitate toward these cool, fun, interactive exhibits, whether it's snowboarding or a 360 selfie that they do with a big phone. I mean, they know exactly what to do and how to interact with it. And our hope is that they will see that math can be fun. Maybe adding up a column of numbers might seem a little bit boring, but the application of that is very cool, and we work on amazing things at Raytheon, and we want them to come work for us someday.
Now, you started this exhibit off at the Smithsonian in D.C.
2012, we launched Math Alive, and it's a traveling exhibit designed to stay at different venues for a few months and then move on. Perfect for families that want to bring the kids out, or maybe teachers who want to do a field trip. I mean, it's just ideal for that. So we've been all over the world. We started at the Smithsonian, as you said, in 2012, and then we've moved to many, many places. We like to locate it near military installations, too, because STEM education being our number one community outreach, but supportive military families is number two. So a venue like Pearl Harbor is perfect for us, right? We've got the STEM element there with this exhibit, and then we have the military families that are nearby who we hope will visit.
So you have more than one exhibits are happening at the same time?
No, we don't. The same exhibit travels to different venues. So it'll be in, let's say, Dallas, Texas for 4 months, and then it'll move to Phoenix, Arizona, Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. Or it's been around the world, and now it's coming to Hawaii, and we're delighted. I mean, it's just great because we'll be here 8 months, which will be the longest run for Math Alive. And we do hope that thousands of families and children, young people, will take advantage of this.
I mean, it's a neat thing because for folks who don't have the opportunity to travel and maybe see these various exhibits that might kind of spark kids' interest, you're bringing it here.
Oh, yeah. Robotics, space, I mean, you name it. Even sports, games, design, all the things that young people are interested in, this shows them the math behind that. So it's inspiring for them. And most of all, it's fun. I mean, you go and watch, and everybody's got a smile on their face. And it's a little bit like an amusement park experience, but wrapped in math and science.
And I'm just curious, since you've taken it to other countries, mm-hmm. are there any cultural differences or, you know, just reactions to what they're seeing?
Isn't it interesting? Kids are kids, right? I mean, they react the same way. I've watched them in other parts of the world. They They immediately get it. They're digital natives, right? They grew up in a world where all they've ever known are cell phones and laptops, et cetera. And so technology, math, and science is something that, you know, inherently is part of their world and part of their makeup. They just may not see how it directly applies to them and what they do. But, yeah, they all react the same way, excited and immediately immersing themselves in the fun technology.
So when this sets up shop at Pearl Harbor, is it you pay the admission there and it's part of the displays?
Yeah, it's a great deal. If you want to go to the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, you just pay your entry fee and this is included in that. So you get in there free and the military families get in there at a very reduced rate or free. So it's a great deal. Raytheon underwrites the whole thing. The idea is we want them to come in. We don't want it to be difficult for parents or for young people. You know, get out there, enjoy it, immerse yourself in the technology. Understand that, you know, math is cool. It's fun. Yeah, we surveyed young people before we ever launched this to find out how they felt about math and science. And I have some fun facts I might share with you. 61% of kids said they'd rather take out the trash than do their math homework. Are you kidding me? And it's even higher for the kids who would rather eat broccoli than do math and science, right? So inherently they might resist that. So we want them to understand that it's cool. It's fun to do it, and we have so many talented engineers at Raytheon who are really innovating the future. And that's what we're looking to see, that next group to come through.
And I understand that you've got some kind of partnership going where we can help folks out with the transportation if there are, like, field trips?
Yes. So if teachers are listening and they're interested, there's a number that they can call. And if you'll permit me, I'll take a minute and give you that phone number. It's 441-1000. And that's a way that teachers who are listening to this could call that number and reserve a spot for a field trip. I mean, we've already got almost 4,000 students signed up for this thing. It hasn't even opened yet. So there's a lot of interest already.
Right. So maybe if there are some neighbor island schools that are planning a trip to Oahu, that maybe this is something they could work in there.
Oh, yeah. They also could visit the website, www.pearlharboraviationmuseum.org. And that's a great place to get a lot of information, too. We'll be here 8 months, so plenty of opportunity, plenty of time for teachers to line up field trips and for parents to bring their young people out there.
And so I'm curious, how do you know that what you're doing is meeting its goal?
Oh, wow. Thank you for asking that question. 10, 12 years ago, when we first started our STEM outreach efforts as a company, Raytheon said, we're going to focus a lot of our community outreach on STEM and promoting STEM education. We targeted middle school kids and high school kids, early 9th, 10th grade. That's 10 or 12 years ago. Today, we're hiring the first group of those former students to come to work for us. So in effect, we're creating our own talent pipeline. It's so interesting to talk to them as early career employees and say, you know, what is it that made you want to be an engineer? Well, there was a Raytheon engineer who was at a math day or a tutoring day or a math and science day, and I just was inspired by what they were doing and what their career was all about, and so I wanted to do that too. That's success for us.
Okay. And so if folks have grandkids out there and they want to kind of spark their interest, I mean, you folks have worked a lot with the Scouts, right, the Boys and Girl Scouts, to try and get this whole STEM emphasis going.
We have a tight relationship with the Girl Scouts. It's a new partnership that we have nationwide. And then we're also very active with the Boys and Girls Club of America. So we are working very hard to make sure we are where the young people are. We've set up centers of innovation in Boys and Girls Clubs clubs that are near military bases or on military bases. Again, if we can combine STEM education with military family support, well, that's a win-win for us. Our military is our end-use customer for what Raytheon produces, and so to help them on and off the battlefield is really a win for us.
Okay, good fit.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for stopping by.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Raytheon's John Patterson talking about Math Alive, a new exhibit designed with middle schoolers in mind. It opens tomorrow and, again, runs for 8 months at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. Besides touching on sports, music, dance, and movies, the exhibit also features a new segment on weather and cyber science. For links about the transportation grants, thanks to the Freeman Foundation, check out our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In HPR's Atherton studio on Thursday the 15th, it's Listening While Muslim, the B-side. This listening party will take you on a musical journey through an intersection of identity, politics, and culture. It's led by Shangri-La Curator of Programs, Asad Ali Jafri, and MC Naveed Najafi. Reserve your seat at hprtickets.org. Presented by Shangri-La Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design in partnership with HPR Generation Listen.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk about a new aquaculture accelerator forming through a strategic partnership with NELHA, the Hawaii Strategic Development Corporation, and UH. We'll talk to the director of the Natural Energy Lab of Hawaii to learn about the goals of the accelerator and the opportunity aquaculture has for Hawaii. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
It's that time of day to check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today's reality check, a curious story about an architect who left his mark everywhere in our Honolulu, but vanished without a trace decades ago. Joining us online this morning is Honolulu Civil Beat columnist Denby Fawcett. Morning.
Morning.
You know, full disclosure, I know you invited me to go along on a walking tour, which is where we learned about this architect, Edwin Bauer.
Yes, it was so interesting. When a little modest walk-up in Kapahulu was pointed out to us, you know, something you look at, but you think, wow, it's nice, but then you just go on your way. And this was by Bauer. So that, we were thinking, how fascinating that someone would put so much architectural interest and detail into such a modest little project.
So tell us about this unsolved mystery, though.
Well, Edwin Bauer, I found out about this later because I started reading more and more about him after our tour, and I was just stunned to find out that he got on a city bus in March in 1984 and was never seen again. Someone saw him getting on the bus on Kuhio Avenue, and then he disappeared. And, of course, the missing persons detail in Honolulu Police Department searched for him. For many, many months, the family came in. There were notices on TV and in the papers, but he was never found. And he had Alzheimer's, and he could barely see. His family said he had only 5% vision. But in spite of that, his everyday routine was to use his senior bus pass to go around the island, and that would be his day's event.
And it's amazing because, you know, he's, I think at the time they actually offered a reward, but nothing ever came of it.
Yes, they did. They offered, they started out, you know, you have to think, this is back in 84, so this is kind of big money, although it doesn't seem like it today. Initially, they offered $500 for information about him to help find him. And then as the year went on, that escalated to $5,000. But nobody came forward, and they never got any leads on it.
Now, you've been in touch with his family, too.
Yes, I have. And his daughter, Paula Bauer, is an artist herself, and she lives in Pennsylvania. She was a student at Punahou School and grew up here. And she's very pleased because what's happening now, interestingly, just as though Bauer disappeared, kind of attention to his architecture disappeared, and he was forgotten in the list of great mid-century modern architects in Hawaii. And she's very happy now because there's a revival of interest in him, and she's surprised and delighted.
Right, and this was a type of what, mid-century modern architecture. The tour that we went on was put on by Dokomomo.
Yes, this is a type of architecture that's getting increasing attention today with our buildings so tall and so they could fit in anywhere, so many of the buildings in Honolulu today. And mid-century modern was the period that was started by a bunch of brilliant young men who happened to just come here during World War II to work. There was great amounts of work for the Navy and for the military, for architects. So they were drawn here by jobs because they were young people barely out of school. And they turned out to be the most creative architects many people believe have ever been seen here. And also, it was a period of great money being spent. It was, you know, they were here after the war, after statehood, when there was a huge building boom going on. So there was a lot of money to pay for their work and to support them. And the reason people like their work in general, these are people like Ossipoff, Alfred Price, George Pete Wimberly, most of what they did had a Hawaii touch to it, which is missing in a lot of the architecture today. It had a Hawaiian feel because they were mostly from the mainland, and they were enchanted by this place.
And it's amazing to think that Bauer designed so many things, so many different types of buildings, including the Breakers Hotel in Waikiki, which is just charming.
Yeah, so these are now, it's funny that millennials love these little walk-up hotels, the Breakers, the White Sands, the Hawaiiana, the Surf Jack, and they're getting their own revival because they have a humanity and a texture that is missing in the high-rise hotels today. So they're now being restored and remodeled and much loved by a certain sector of visitors.
And it's nice that Edwin Bauer is coming back.
Yes, I mean, you feel good, you know.
Yes.
I felt so sorry when I read about his disappearance to think, you know, what a sad way to go when you've contributed so much. Like, you look at, we're walking around, now people call them Bowers when referring to his buildings, but every day we're walking past Bowers, like, for example, the Waikiki Business Plaza or Hilton Lagoon Tower, or these little hotels, and we're thinking, oh, that's nice, nice place. But we don't really know who did it. We
right.
just know we like it.
Right. He's nowhere to be found, but now he's everywhere. But thank you so much, Denby.
Oh, you're welcome, Catherine. Thank you.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat columnist Denby Fawcett. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org. Joining us this morning is HPR's Noe Tanigawa. She's been hanging out with the University of Hawaii professor post-election, who says America's founders were all for liberty and justice, but democracy, not so much.
How does that happen, right? Well, the vote counting's still going on, let's face it. And hopefully we won't be seeing this vote counting as some like quaint, antiquated custom soon. With these elections here, I gave a call to UH Manoa history professor Marcus Daniel. His specialty is revolutionary and early America, because I wanted to touch back on the ideals that propel this country forward. Hopefully they're not running out of steam. And I always thought democracy was one of those founding ideals, like built in, like, you know, when we originally made the batter of this cake. But according to Professor Daniel, democracy? No.
The founders certainly didn't believe in a kind of an unalloyed democracy. They talked about freedom, they talked about liberty, but they didn't talk about democracy. And they often, when they did, they talked about it in pejorative terms. They saw democracy actually as problematic and often as a threat, being what Republicans today would call mob rule.
They didn't see liberty, justice, and democracy as necessarily linked. So, I mean, how did they get linked?
Well, gradually, over time. I mean, I think that's something that we've had to fight for, you know, since the revolution itself, the gradual expansion of American systems of political representation to reflect the ideals of the founding period.
So Professor Daniel's saying that democracy is extremely idealistic, and it seemed to Americans to be a fair way to operate to achieve those goals of the founders. freedom, and equality. And now we've just been struggling for 200 years to make the system work. Democracy, defined as one person, one vote, has been a process. Okay, that whole process got a boost when they took out the property-owning requirement. Okay, then in 1920, women got the vote. Okay, that made us a little closer to democracy, one person, one vote. Then Professor Marcus says we didn't really have anything close to democracy until the 1960s when we had the civil rights laws come in and when some of those racial barriers to voting were supposedly abolished. Now, Professor Daniel's British, and that is where 70 to 80% of the population votes there in Britain. Why don't Americans vote since we've lowered the barriers? Supposedly everybody can. Daniel said when he first arrived in America, he couldn't understand why people didn't vote. But,
you know, in many ways, Americans don't get a lot from their government. My own experience sort of informs this. You know, you pay taxes in a place like England or Germany. You at least get health care and public education that is really pretty good. And I think a lot of Americans feel they don't get much in return, and there's some reality to that.
That's kind of, it kind of makes sense. You know? So we have a government that doesn't provide health care or necessarily a great education or maybe the infrastructure we expect, and we want lower taxes, and we wonder why people don't vote. Huh. Well, not only that. The entire process is under attack right now. President Trump has tweeted since the midterms that the Florida election, quote, large numbers of new ballots showed up out of nowhere. Many ballots are missing or forged. An honest vote count no longer possible. Ballots massively infected. Direct quote from a tweet from our president. On Arizona's race, our president tweeted, in Arizona, signatures don't match. Electoral corruption. Call for a new election. We must protect our democracy. Now, CNN has reported that nothing in those tweets is accurate.
I think this is what people are beginning to talk about, where the system itself, the democratic political system, becomes more and more tenuous. It holds the allegiance of Americans less and less. And you know, that's what worries me about the cynicism, about the sense. You know, in Germany in the 1920s, you know, before the rise of fascism, you know, one of the most common kind of political discourses was a sort of contempt for politics, this sort of do-nothing political system. And I think that's the sort of basis for then thinking about alternatives to that. So I see the cynicism as potentially very problematic.
If elections can't be trusted, well, what good is democracy? I mean, you really want to get stuff done? How about fascism?
Oh, goodness.
Hey! You know what? This past weekend, New York Times reported on how Silicon Valley is loving the sort of doomsday forecast of a certain futurist philosopher. His name is Yuval Noah Harari. And he's worried that the power of media to influence huge swaths of the population is destroying the idea of free will. And when so many people can be so easily influenced by social media and so on, why even ask them what they think? I mean, you can frankly just tell them what to think is you know, kind of the inference of his fear. And what's interesting is that Mark Zuckerberg, for example, said it was just recently in a New Yorker article was talking about a certain despot, Caesar Augustus. He said, Mr. Zuckerberg said, quote, basically, through a really harsh approach, he established 200 years of world peace.
Interesting.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, hey, nobody had time to vote anyway, right, Catherine?
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny, though, because you know, you try and go back, right, our founding fathers, you know, the ideas that our country was built on, and what was the intent of the time, you know, when we created the Constitution and talked about these ideals of every vote counts in democracy.
I know. And to think that they weren't really tied to democracy at that time. And what Professor Daniel says is that they would actually be horrified to know that today, in 200 plus years later, we're trying to parse their words to know exactly what they meant. They meant for the document to change, is what Professor Daniel thinks.
Oh, a living document changing,
for
morphing.
The times.
Interesting.
And what would it be today?
Wow. Okay, that's food for
Maybe
thought.
We'd be afraid to ask, like another con.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, thanks so much, Nui.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Nui Tanigawa talking about democracy as we come off the general election and the recounts all across the country. You can find her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Mike Smith from Navy Region Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman from The World. So much going on right now.
I wouldn't be surprised if Mohammed bin Salman wanted to target certain individuals in Iran. But
sometimes you need a scorecard.
We are going to give the ceasefire an opportunity. We hope it holds. If it doesn't, Israel is...
Watching The World in real time, bringing it to you. Join us for the next edition of The World.
This afternoon at 1.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a popular diving site found 3 miles out from the Hoikai Marina. As the story goes, a pilot's routine training mission suddenly went awry mid-flight. The plane started to sputter, and the engine died. The seasoned airman executed a smooth water landing, wheels up, flaps slightly extended, successfully touching down intact. Unfortunately, with no way to lift the craft out of the water, gravity took over and it settled at the bottom of the ocean. This is one of the rare wrecks that was not sunk intentionally to become an artificial reef. 70 years in the ocean has turned the World War II plane into a lush habitat for garden eels, octopi, frogfish, and stingrays. It's recommended only that advanced divers attempt this scuba adventure to the upright remains of the Corsair wreck, sitting at a depth of 105 feet in strong and unpredictably swift currents. And congratulations to Frank from Sand Island. You got that right. You got the answer. That is today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Joe Boyven from Young Brothers. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Find our stories on Twitter or tweet us at HI Conversation.
Micronesia is chock full of wrecked ships and aircraft from World War II. Today we hear from master diver Brandy Mueller, who co-wrote a book entitled Airplane Graveyard, home to 150 planes in waters off Kwajalein.
So I was living on Kwajalein Atoll, which is part of the Marshall Islands, but the U.S. Army has a military base there. And there was a big World War II battle there. And at the end of World War II, there was lots of extra military surplus and whatnot, and they dumped about 150 American airplanes just into the lagoon. So they didn't crash there. They were pushed in there. So they're all in very good shape. So as a scuba diver on Kwajalein, we get to go and dive these wrecks. I was hired as a civilian contractor as a boat captain. So I was driving a ferry boat mostly between the main island that the Army leases and then the Ibai, which is a local island where the majority of the Marshallese population lives, and the Army base employs a lot of the Marshallese. So I was sort of the bus that took them to work back and forth.
Tell us, I mean, for folks who've never gone diving in this part of the world, what's it like?
It's really beautiful. It's very close to the equator, and it's a very healthy marine environment. So there's lots of fish, there's lots of coral, crystal clear blue water, kind of all of that dreamy blue water, white sand, palm tree type thing. The wrecks are very cool. They've become sort of encrusted with marine life. So there's kind of yellow and red sponges on them, all kinds of fish, sometimes a shark or two, turtles, lots of fun stuff to see.
And how long have you been working on this book?
It took a little bit over a year total. So, and I guess actually before that, about 3 years of taking photos of the airplane, but just focusing on the book about a year. So I teamed up with Alan Axelrod, who co-wrote it, and he helped with a lot of the sort of hardcore history stuff. So we were examining the airplanes that are in the graveyard and what role they played in the Pacific Theater of World War II. So it's sort of a diving sort of, I get to take you diving and tell you about all the things you see on the wrecks, and then he adds in what the planes were doing in World War II. So it's kind of nice that it hopefully will interest all sorts of people.
And so did you grow up hanging out in the ocean, or are you from cold country?
I grew up in Wisconsin, but I had relatives who lived in Hawaii and also in Florida, so I had at an early age gone to visit and saw these amazing places with ocean and warm weather. So I went to grad school in Hawaii, and I actually became a diver when I was in high school, but then dove more when I got into college. I still remember the first dive a friend took me on the airplane graveyard, and I was just kind of overwhelmed. I think when you see shipwrecks underwater, it feels like they should sort of be there, but airplanes just seem super crazy to be underwater and be surrounded by fish. So it just seems really surreal to sort of descend down and then see an airplane in the sand. So in the graveyard, all the airplanes are American airplanes. So they were all planes that were, most likely fought in battles and came back. And, you know, they survived and the pilots survived. But also in Kwajalein, there are some planes that went down during the battles, both American and Japanese. So close by, there's a Zero that's very mangled, that something had happened to it during the war. So I guess one of the cool things about the graveyard is that all the planes were sort of successful in battle, and none of them were crashed or anything like that. They were just sort of disposed of at the end of the war. I just think it's really amazing how the marine life on these airplanes, as well as on wrecks all over the world, how the ocean sort of covers these metal beasts of war and turns them into sort of colorful, and this whole new life takes form underwater. I find that really amazing. Right now I'm working part of the year in Chuuk, which used to be known as Truk Lagoon, and that area has a lot of Japanese World War II wrecks that were sank. And yeah, I would love to show people more of those and tell the stories of those ships, as well as other World War II ships and planes around the world.
Yeah, because marine archaeology is just, it's fascinating.
It is, and there's a lot that we haven't found yet. There's several projects that are looking for other sort of MIA soldiers as well as aircraft in both Kwajalein and Truk Lagoon and other places around the world. The book has a lot of photos, and I've got photos of all seven different types of aircraft that are found in the graveyard, as well as some other photos from Kwajalein. There's some of the wreck photos and also some above water stuff, so you can sort of see the island. And we've also put in some National Archives historical photos, so you can see what the planes look like before they ended up underwater. And then also the planes underwater with some of the marine life you see and sharks and things like that. Kwajalein, one thing with Kwajalein is it's hard to access because you have to be either working on Kwajalein or sort of an invited guest to go there. There's no commercial dive operation, so getting there is a bit difficult.
That was Brandi Mueller, co-author of the book Airplane Graveyard. She dove to depths of 120 feet to capture images of the planes, and historian Alan Axelrod researched the history of the planes before they ended up on the bottom of the ocean, a book to enthrall history buffs and divers.
I'm Ira Glass, This Week on This American Life. One of the people who works here at the radio show, a scientist by training, thinks that there is no such thing as free will. So I would say he decided to do a story for our show about that. He would say he had no choice. Atoms and neurons inside him turned and churned like pieces of a machine, and he did what they commanded. This Week.
Saturday afternoon at 1.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll be taking a look at Parking by Permit. That's a program that was started in the Wilson Track neighborhood in Kalihi. The city's considering expanding the pilot to other neighborhoods. Do you have a parking problem on your street? We want to hear your story. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call us on our live hour-long show. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow with more of The Conversation.